You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In April, after a building called Rana Plaza collapsed in Bangladesh, over 1,000 garment workers were killed. It was the industry's deadliest disaster. While retailers have promised better safety inspections and improved conditions, how much has really changed in the months since? And has consumer demand for the cheap clothing produced at those factories declined? With Fashion Week starting tomorrow, we have invited Elizabeth L. Klein, the author of Overdress, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion, which is published by Portfolio, to our show today. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me on.
You traveled to Bangladesh as part of your research for the book. How many people there are working in the garment industry?
There's about 5,000 factories and 4 million people employed in the garment industry, and those numbers have just skyrocketed over the past 5 to 10 years as the industry has moved out of China, where the cost of labor, cost of doing business has gone up, and so the fashion industry is always looking for the new cheap place to produce clothes, and that is Bangladesh currently.
But isn't China still involved in many instances with what's coming out of Bangladesh?
Say that again?
Don't Chinese middlemen play
a
role in what's coming from Bangladesh? So are they just passing on the manufacture jobs to Bangladesh, the jobs that come to them, have come to them in the past?
Yeah, that's a pretty accurate assessment. It's interesting because Chinese middlemen, so factory owners, will actually move their factory work to Bangladesh as well because the labor is cheaper there.
But still, I gather there are 30 million people working in just one province of China, 40 million garment workers in just one province of China right now. So China is still the major supplier of inexpensive garments.
Right, and that's part of the reason why there's so much pressure on Bangladesh, because no one can do what China has done in terms of the size of the labor force and also the sophistication, the difference in the factories in China in terms of technology, cleanliness, organization. Chinese factories are really world class, and then, you know, you go to Bangladesh and it's the factories there are very bare bones. They're very primitive, and these factories have a lot of pressure on them to produce the same order sizes and produce the same quality level that China has been doing. And it's very difficult for a developing country like Bangladesh to do something like that.
The average Chinese garment worker makes $235 a month, pretty low by American standards, but still a lot compared to $50 a month in Bangladesh.
Right, I know. And, you know, I there are headlines coming out of China every day saying that the cost of labor just continue to go up. I was actually talking to a leather manufacturer yesterday who was telling me that because the faux leather industry is based in China and the prices are going up so quickly there, that a faux leather jacket is almost the same price just based on costs as real leather coming out of China now. And that's just a good reflection of skyrocketing costs in that country.
What kind of safety inspections were being conducted in Bangladesh's factories before the Rana Plaza collapse?
I would say that, the auditing process for major brands is pretty similar in all countries. It doesn't matter if it's Bangladesh or China, which is to say that they happen usually annually or semi-annually. So you walk through with a checklist and you look to see that there are fire extinguishers, for example, clearly marked exits. But in the case of the Tazreen fire last November, where 112 people died, I think it was something like the auditor had gone through the factory and saw that there were fire extinguishers, but no one thought to see if there were fire escapes. You know, it's this kind of a sort of...
Or where the doors were locked.
Right, which is something that an auditor would never... They're not going to see that because that's something that happens once they leave.
And I'm assuming that there are pretty lax building codes in Bangladesh.
Yeah, absolutely, which is something, I'm not a building inspector, but when I was in Bangladesh, that's something you can see with... It's very clear to the naked eye that buildings are structurally unsound. And that building actually illegally added 4 floors. And that's why the building fell down, because it was... illegally constructed.
And one worker said that there had been large cracks visible in the building the day before the collapse.
Yeah.
Nobody had reported that?
Yeah. The workers saw it, and they were required to come to work the next day.
When you were in Bangladesh, weren't there electricity outages?
Yes. There are major infrastructure problems in the country. I don't understand brands. It seemed like a very difficult place to do business, and it just really proved how alluring low cost is. You know, that you would actually, there are traffic jams in the capital, and there's also a lot of electrical problems, but these brands work there anyway because it's just that much cheaper than anywhere else in the world right now.
Were the five clothing plants that were in Rana Plaza typical of Bangladesh's factories, or were they known for actually paying less than the minimum wage?
From what I've read, we don't know a whole lot about what Rana Plaza was like before the collapse, which is, I would say that's typical. The industry is very murky. It's hard to get information. But as far as we know, they were probably making minimum wage, which is 21 cents an hour. You know, I mean, hopefully they were at least meeting that minimum. How could you not? It's so low, you know.
In the aftermath of the attack, the government temporarily closed 21 factories to prevent unrest. Mm-hmm. Have workers been protesting conditions?
Yeah, and there's actually quite a robust garment unionization effort in Bangladesh. The government has suppressed it over the last couple of years, but now that there's so much international scrutiny on Bangladesh, labor groups are getting stronger, and clearly there's so much attention on the country right now that I think that workers are in a good position to change their conditions moving forward.
Maybe this is silly on my part, but I've always wondered why in a country that's had two women as presidents, the women who work in these garment factories are just treated so shabbily.
You know what? I can't even begin to answer that question. I think that what we're seeing is a country that is extremely poor, doing whatever they can to not scare off Western brands because they need that money to, you know, to grow the economy. But I think that it's pretty well documented how corrupt the government in Bangladesh is and how big the divide is between the workers and these middle class or upper class government workers who oftentimes are coming out of the garment industry. A lot of the politicians in Bangladesh are former factory owners.
My guest is Elizabeth L. Klein. Her book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Do American and European retailers deal directly with the factories in places like Bangladesh and China?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of these big brands, so some of the big players in Bangladesh are Walmart, H&M, Zara, JCPenney, and they would all like us to believe that they know every single one of the factories that they use and that they deal with them directly. But, you know, there was this very shocking Al Jazeera expose that came out last week that just was documented the widespread use of subcontracting amongst brands like Walmart and Gap in particular. So they are aware to a certain degree that their factories that they're using or their agents that they're hiring might pass off an order to a subcontractor or to an illegally run factory or a factory that has not been approved.
Well, do they even visit these factories? I would assume most of the ordering is just simply send us 300 garments in size 3, 6, 12, whatever.
Yeah, every corporation operates a little bit differently. I mean, I think that the cheaper the product, Walmart uses a lot of middlemen, whereas, you know, I've interviewed people who work for Gap who insist that they, you know, because they have a certain quality standard and they're really a brand, that they know every supplier and they vet every supplier, mostly for quality reasons, not necessarily for social compliance reasons. But the more information that comes out of Bangladesh, the more we realize that these corporations in general don't know what's happening down their supply chain. They really don't.
And after the collapse, many major American retailers pledged to make changes.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know if any of them have followed through?
Well, so
or do they want to know what's going on there?
I think that the factory collapse was, 1,129 people died, and this issue is just not going away. It's been in the news pretty consistently for the last 6 months. And so where we're at right now is the retailers have divided on two different plans to address safety and mainly safety issues in the factories. And a lot of the European brands signed up on this one plan called the Accord on Fire and Building Safety in Bangladesh. So H&M and Zara were among the first to sign on to it. And that's the better plan because it's legally binding and it promises as much money as necessary to fix the factories. Then on the other side of the fence, we have these rogue American and Canadian retailers, Walmart, Gap, JCPenney, and Macy's, who have their own separate plan that is not legally binding. So they can back out at any point, and they're offering just a set amount of money, not dependent on how much is actually needed to fix the factories.
Is there any way to monitor if they're following through on their pledges, either of the plans?
That's a really good question. Right now, the American plan, they were supposed to meet last week to sort of hammer out the final details of how it was going to work. So the next question will be, okay, that's really great that you're going to do this, but how are you going to show to consumers that you're actually following through on that? I think it's a really good question.
A report by Worker Rights Consortium that estimates that proper safety conditions and working wages would cost Western consumers about 10 cents more for each garment that's exported from Bangladesh for the next 4 years. Now, that's not much, but is that likely to happen?
You know, it's I love that statistic because I feel like currently fashion companies would move the country that they're producing in over 10 cents per garment. That's really the level that these companies think on and the sort of bottom line.
I mean, if I can get 10 cents less from El Salvador, I'll move my operation from Bangladesh?
Absolutely. That's in the way these companies think, that is how they think about it. But should they think about it that way? Absolutely not. Considering how much profit they make per year, it's pretty disturbing.
You said that the factories in China have better working conditions. We've been hearing about terrible working conditions in China as well. So are we just talking about
relative
changes?
I would say that conditions in China definitely improved over the last decade. And that's another layer of this that is just so tragic. And that's really been the history of the legacy of the fashion industry over the last 30 years is they move into a country because it's cheap. They move into China and things get better. Living standards go up, cost of labor goes up, and they decide, oh, it's too expensive in this country. Let's go somewhere else and start over. So,
my guest is Elizabeth L. Klein. Her book From Portfolio, which is an imprint of Penguin Books, is Overdress, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Elizabeth L. Klein, whose book From Portfolio is Overdress, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. You mentioned that this cheap fashion trend started around 20 years ago?
I mean, you can trace cheap fashion back to the very beginning of ready-to-wear clothing 100 years ago. I would say that this shift in consumer consciousness where people actually were comfortable buying cheap clothes and saw it as chic and democratic, I would trace that back to the early 1990s.
So are the clothes that were made before the 1990s better made?
That's a good question. I think that prior to, say, 1990, we were still making a lot of clothing in the United States, but clothing was also not made in high volume like it is today. Really, right now, we live under a sort of fast fashion system, which is where we see clothing as disposable good. We go out and buy something for the weekend or buy something for a date. We don't expect it to last a long time. So the quality, the diminishing quality of mass market clothing is partly consumer driven.
I've seen the changes right here in New York because during my lifetime, I remember seeing on 7th Avenue in the area above 34th Street, people pushing dresses and other clothing mm-hmm. down the street. Most of those places closed up when they were moved to the Southwest, to San Antonio, and now
right.
they moved to China?
Well, yeah. I would say that we saw garment production move out of New York and into the South and California first, but that's moving way back into like the 1950s and 60s. And then after NAFTA, it moved to Mexico, into the global South. And then we saw the rise of China as a garment producer, yeah, around the late 1990s. And then it's just completely dominated for the past 10 years until maybe 2 years ago.
Has the cheap fashion trend changed how clothing is marketed? I mean, I think of companies like H&M or Forever 21, and they stress the fact that you can buy something now, it'll be very hip for mm-hmm. the next 6 months, and who cares if it doesn't last any longer than that?
Right. You're exactly right about that. I think that that fast fashion, you know, and that was pioneered by H&M, but before that, Target in the States was doing a good job of changing the way that consumers thought about clothes. You know, it's old fashioned to keep something in your closet forever. You know, just buy something for the season and then throw it out. You don't need it to last. You don't need it to be good quality. But I really do think that fast fashion is itself kind of going out of style now. I'm seeing a lot of consumer fatigue associated with fast fashion. And part of that has to do with Rana Plaza and what's going on in Bangladesh. But it's also because everybody's closets are completely overflowing with clothes, and we kind of have had our fun with this. I think people are a little tired of it.
How long does it take for a design to make it from prototype to store racks of these retailers?
Well, you know, it's we've heard that a company like Zara or H&M can get something into, or Forever 21 can get something into stores in a matter of weeks. I think that that's for the most part an exaggeration, but certainly in a couple of months.
We are buying more clothing than we did in the past. Americans buy 20 billion garments each year, which mm-hmm. averages out to 64 pieces a person.
I think it's 68 now. And what's also really amazing about that is that our consumption has actually doubled since 1991, which, you know, it's shocking. But then when I think back to how I shopped in high school, for example, clothes were so much more expensive that you simply couldn't buy a lot of it. You couldn't afford to.
Let's take a call. We have a call from Susan from Manhattan. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I just want to preface my the call by saying I have been a wardrobe manager stylist for 35 years, and I started the whole movement to buy quality and not quantity.
Started that movement?
I started that movement about 35 years ago. But let's talk about that for a second. When you buy quality, you're buying fit. Mm-hmm. And you're buying good fabrics, and you're buying detailing, and the kind of labor that's put into patterns, and so forth. I think the average young consumer does not understand that. It's more important for her, and I'm gonna be a little prejudiced here, to have disposable clothing, to have changes like every month.
Mm-hmm. I think men wear a lot of T-shirts and other kinds of disposable clothing as well, don't you?
Yeah, but I mean, you can still, I think in general that the quality level for mass market menswear is still higher than women's. It's much easier to just walk into a chain store and find a men's sweater that's not garbage.
Another listener, Matt in Harlem, called in and asked us to distinguish between the garment industry and the fashion industry. And
I love that question.
And I was going to ask you about that because we've been talking mainly about cheap fashion retailers like H&M, Target, Zara, Walmart. What about the fashion designers who'll be putting on runway shows this week in Bryant Park?
Right. So going back to the question, I mean, the garment industry, that's about production. That's about manufacturing a physical product, whereas the fashion industry is about producing image, design, and setting trends. And that's what the runway shows do. They set the trends. But what's interesting is they are also feeling the pressures of the fast fashion system. T Magazine actually wrote a really interesting article. It was either last week or the week before about how some designers are having to produce 10 shows a year now, and that puts a tremendous strain on them. And the reason they're having to do that is because consumers constantly want new product. So it's really not, it's not good for them. It's not good for the planet. It's not good for garment workers. There's just a lot of stress and pressure on the whole system.
Are they also producing their garments in places like Bangladesh?
It really, you have to look at it on a designer by designer basis. I would say, generally speaking, no, because a high-end designer they want to be able to walk into their factory and tweak the fit, make sure they can control the quality. I would say that a lot of runway designers, you know, like Oscar de la Renta, still produces in New York, for example. It's much more common for them to produce domestically.
Some cheap fashion retailers like H&M have introduced lines that are more ethically produced.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a step in the right direction?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are they labeling them as such, and are they selling better?
H&M has a Conscious Collection, which is an eco-friendly capsule collection. Topshop also has an upcycled or recycled collection. I can't think what it's called right now. And then Anthropology has also introduced something similar. And this is a great solution for these companies that have these huge supply chains that they don't have a lot of control over. They can start making steps in the right direction by saying, okay, we're going to partner with this one factory or this one designer and produce a small collection that is done right, and educate consumers that way and take small steps in the right direction.
This is almost like what wine producers do. They have a low-priced wine,
yeah.
And then they say, well, we're going to also give you something from one vineyard and charge you a lot more money.
Well, I mean, from what I know, these ethically produced products, like the Conscious Collection at H&M, it's maybe priced a little bit higher, but they're not asking consumers to pay a premium, and nor should they be for ethically produced products.
My guest is Elizabeth L. Klein. Her book from Portfolio is Overdress, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Some retailers have gone even further, like Eileen Fisher, which has a labeling system that explains whether a garment is fair trade, made in the United States, or made from organically produced fibers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a growing trend?
Yes, absolutely. So transparency is one of the biggest trends that we're seeing in the fashion industry right now. And Everlane is an online retailer that, you know, represents what they call radical transparency. So if you go onto Everlane's website and you want to buy a shirt, you can look at pictures and videos taken inside the factories. You can get to know the factory owner on some level. So it's sort of really similar to the food movement in that they're sharing stories of how these products are made.
You mean like the slow food movement?
Yes, exactly.
Because the feeling was that we had lost touch
mm-hmm.
with how our food was being produced.
Right, and I think that that's part of the reason why an interest in craftsmanship went out the window, because, you know, when factories moved overseas, how could we possibly see how clothes were made or know anything about how clothes were made? So companies like Everlane, and then there was a new startup that launched last week called Zadie, are really trying to fill in that void and say there is a story about how these products were made, and it's actually a really interesting, really beautiful story in a lot of cases.
And then Topshop has a line done in partnership with the eco-label Reclaim.
Yes.
To wear.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
They're making a point of it, and you're saying the prices aren't all that much higher. But this is a problem that's cropped up over the years, hasn't it? In the late 1990s, Nike came under fire for working conditions in its Chinese factories.
Mm-hmm.
Did they make fundamental changes as a result?
Nike, absolutely. I think that Nike, they are great on a sustainability front, and I think that amongst the big corporations, their code of conduct and their auditing system is decent. You know, I don't understand why Gap, who came under the same amount of fire, has not made the same commitment to ethics.
Maybe because they don't have to.
Yeah, I think part of the reason is because they're a fashion company and Nike sells sportswear, you know? People will pay more money for a sneaker, whereas Gap has to compete with H&M. I feel like they kind of don't know where they fit in the market anymore.
There's been a long tradition in the garment industry of poor treatment of workers. The mills in the United States and the UK during the Industrial Revolution, the shirt waist triangle, the Triangle Fire?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sweatshops are still all over New York City and elsewhere. So what's happening here? Did we just export the problem?
No, you're skipping over a kind of a big chunk of history. I would say that the garment industry, in the 1950s and 60s, was unionized. It was a path to the middle class. So what we have seen is the erosion of garment work. It has gone back to where it was 100 years ago. But that's not to say that it's never been a good job. It has been, and it still can be.
Now, we've been talking about working conditions, but isn't cheap fashion also hard on the environment?
Yes, absolutely.
Because of the way cotton is produced, but also synthetics, mm-hmm. dyeing?
Right. The fashion industry is incredibly water and energy intensive. The dyeing process, leather tanning, all of these processes are toxic. They do have a high environmental toll, and that toll, for the most part, is being taken out in places like China and Brazil, which has claimed most of our textile industry. But it's not something that gets talked about a lot. We seem to be aware of the environmental impact of buying a plastic bottle, but yet we don't think about that when we buy a polyester shirt.
And we also think that when we're buying something in cotton, that we're doing something that's good for the environment, despite the fact that cotton requires a lot of pesticides in the growing process. And we've exported that to places like China, India, and Pakistan.
Right. And, I think that all textiles have an environmental footprint. The issue is overconsumption. We're simply just buying too much of it, and these companies aren't doing enough to reduce the impact of the fabrics and materials that they're using.
A couple of people have written in to ask about things. Sophie in Manhattan wonders how parents can educate their kids about shopping for clothes more responsibly.
That's a good question.
Because the kids are often the ones who are buying at the least expensive places.
Right. I found when I travel and talk to college students, for example, they've really surprised me because they're I think that college campuses have gone back to thrift stores are once again really popular. Clothing swaps are really popular, which is where you trade clothes with your friends or other students. And DIY fashion is also really huge. You can go on YouTube and look at DIY fashion tutorials and figure out how to make, cut up a t-shirt and make, totally restyle it. So I think that young people, they've got it right. I think that we can learn a lot from what they're doing on college campuses, for example, right now.
And so, one way to shop responsibly is to look at the labels and see just how much we can learn from them.
I mean, it depends. If you're talking about looking at a label from a company like Eileen Fisher, where there's actually information on that label as to whether or not it's organic or made in the USA, then the label is helpful.
But let's say I'm looking at a men's shirt and it says 100% cotton fabricated in Malaysia. I don't know what that means.
Right. How could you? And so that's where there's a gap right now. I think that there's an interest in ethical fashion. There's a demand for transparency from the consumer, and mass market fashion companies have yet to catch up with the interest from consumers. Like, you should be able to walk into a store and look at a label and know where that product is from, and more importantly, how it was made.
Jenny from Brooklyn left this comment on our show page. She says, I just want to thank Elizabeth. Since first hearing her talk about the Rana Plaza collapse, I've completely changed my consumption habits. I no longer shop at Joe Fresh, H&M, Zara, etc., and have done exclusive research into what companies use fair labor standards. Mm-hmm. If it's unclear from a company's website, I write to them and ask them for an explanation or an explication of their labor policy. I now want transparency in the supply chain, and I'm grateful to be awakened to a huge injustice that I have been largely oblivious to. One of your fans.
Well, I mean, you know, and my life was also transformed through the process of writing the book.
So. Now, not everybody's going to look at the websites of all of the producers of manufactured garments. So
I know. That's what I'm saying. These corporations really need to make it easier for consumers. And I think that you were asking earlier if the demand for cheap fashion has gone down. It's really hard to document because these companies are growing so fast. Like H&M is constantly opening new locations. I actually was reading that they...
Now, they're a Dutch company, aren't they?
They're Swedish. So they're not pulling out of Bangladesh, but they're starting to look at Ethiopia as a manufacturing center because... That's how much clothing they're making. They're like scouring the world looking for new places to open factories.
Elizabeth L. Klein's book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion, is published by Portfolio, which is an imprint of Penguin Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.